And now, it's time to sit back and enjoy the Two True Freaks Internet Radio Broadcast.
Stop it!
Genesis!
What's in the box?
Disenfranchised by the modern comics industry, producer Paul Spataro, Dr. Bill Robinson, and Scott H. Gardner now
ply the time stream in a never-ending quest to rediscover and reconnect with that unique brand of fun and excitement that can only truly be found in good old-fashioned, randomly selected comic book back issues. Journey with them now. Back to the bins.
I got nothing else.
Hello and welcome to Back to the Bins. I am calling this episode A Song of Fire and Ice by two guys that can't carry a tune. That will become clear in just a moment. Hi, I'm Scott Gardner. Joining me for this episode, as always, is the producer, Paul Spataro. How's it going, buddy?
Hello.
Oh, see what I mean?
Oh, I know I can't sing. I can't sing. I can't dance. I can't play an instrument. But, you know.
But you can
Doesn't stop me from pretending.
But you can podcast like nobody's business. All right, so this time around, the whole fire and ice thing, we are looking at is it safe to call these classics, you think? Two classic tales. Well,
they're both like 50 years old. At
right.
Least 50 years old. So I think classic is okay.
These are two team-ups. One of them, the first team-up between these two characters, but two team-up stories of the Human Torch and the Iceman. And so I'm just going to go ahead and hand it off to Paul for the first one here.
All right. So, yeah, you know, this came up just to give a little background on it. I recently went to the local show and came back and I posted the books that I had purchased. And I had purchased a copy of Strange Tales number 120. And Scott said, "Ooh, we should do a show on that." I can't tell you how many times Scott says, "Ooh, we should do a show on that." He turns into, what is it, Joey Ross? Ooh. That guy. But yeah, I was all for it. And I said, yeah, let's do it. And then when we started planning what to do today, I could, you know, you could see the light bulb go on over Scott's head and said, ooh, let's do Marvel Team Up number 23 also. So I am 100% on board for this. And we'll talk a little bit more about Marvel Team Up later, because right now we're doing Strange Tales number 120, which was released in... it was released on February 11th, 1964, and the cover date is May of 1964. The cover shows the Torch and the Iceman side by side in front of a crowd that they're protecting and facing off against pirates on the deck of a boat. The text tells us it had to happen. The Human Torch meets the Iceman, the teenage masters of heat and cold, fighting side by side for the very first time. It also tells us, also in this jam-packed issue, Doctor Strange enters the House of Shadows. But we won't be covering that part of the book, so don't worry about that. The cover is credited to Jack Kirby, George Russos, Stan Goldberg, and Artie Simek. The tale is appropriately titled The Torch Meets the Iceman, written by Stan Lee and Jack Kirby, and I found it interesting that Kirby got a writing credit, penciled by Dick Ayers, colored by Stan Goldberg, lettered by Sam Rosen, and edited by Stan Lee. Our story opens in the headquarters of the Fantastic Four, where Johnny Storm, the Human Torch, is reading the newspaper Exploits of the X-Men and commenting about the fact that the Iceman is being called a frozen version of the Human Torch. Sue and Reed indulge Johnny's self-involved ego, while the Thing carries some heavy Kirby tech. Johnny drops the subject because he has a hot date with Dory Evans that night and is hoping to get some. It seems they're taking a trip around Manhattan, perhaps on the same ship where my wedding and reception were held. Cut to Xavier's School of Gifted Youngsters, where all of the boys are known to be lusting after the one female student. Bobby Drake, the Iceman, is unaware that they will eventually retcon him to be gay and is joining in the desire for sexual conquest. Ultimately, in a coincidence that only occurs in comics, he decides to take a cruise around the city because there are a lot of swinging teens on these cruises. He reverts to his human form and takes a cab to the city and arrives just a moment too late, so he creates himself an ice path and a frozen vaulting pole to get on board. Once on board, he attempts to hit on Dory, who rebuffs him in favor of the Torch, who quickly dismisses Bobby. Unbeknownst to Johnny, Bobby freezes the two sodas he's holding, but Johnny melts them with his own powers, probably making them undrinkable, but they ignore that. Meanwhile, a group of pirates led by the Barracuda board the ship and accost the passengers at gunpoint. The Torch melts one pirate's gun and shuffles Dory off to a safe area. While this is going on, Bobby ices up and joins the fray. He ices the gun of one pirate, but is quickly thawed out when the Torch flies by. At the Barracuda's command, they spray Bobby with a hose, causing him to become encased in ice. They also use a canvas to cover the Torch, and when he burns his way out, it starts a fire that distracts him and allows the pirates to shove him overboard into the Hudson River. Meanwhile, the Iceman frees himself and creates some giant snowballs that allow him to bowl over the pirates and melt the fire and extinguish it. The pirates use gasoline to counter the Iceman's attack, but the Torch returns and traps the pirates in a circle of flame. Not giving up so easily, the Barracuda manages to use Dory as a hostage, but as he tries to make his getaway, is stopped by an ice jam and is then raised skyward by a mound of ice. The Torch quickly flies by and grabs Dory, whilst the Iceman makes a quick getaway on a path of ice squares to the shore as Dory and Johnny contemplate what he's really like. So this has all the elements of your classic Silver Age team up, except because it's in a split book, it doesn't have the initial fight between the two when they first meet.
Right. Yeah, you know, that's a good catch. Yeah, that's...
I think if this was a full-sized adventure, we would have had that first.
Yeah, that's an excellent catch, because I didn't even realize that. And yeah, with this being a Marvel book, that was such a trope of Marvel that the first time they meet, they got a fight. So yeah, this one actually does play against type in that regard. Good catch.
Yeah, they kind of both, like, admire, except for the little... you know, thing with Dory when they're volleying for her attention. Except right. for that, they kind of admire each other through this.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which is, you know, not typical. But again, I think I suspect that if, you know, this had 10 more pages, we would have seen a little fight before they started to admire each other. The Barracuda, interestingly, is not a one and done character. He was later seen in Submariner, which I vaguely remember reading, and then in more modern books he was there, but I don't believe I ever read any of those.
Well, maybe you can solve a mystery for me, because as soon as it got to wherever, I forget which page it is, where it gave his name, Captain Barracuda, I was like, oh, that's Kazar's brother, but it's not.
That would be the Plunderer would be Kazar's brother.
Yeah, I don't know why I'm confusing the two, but I really did think that's who he was. And yeah, I don't know. Anyway, I wanted to do this issue primarily because I actually own this one, and I've always been, you know, rather proud to own this one. I've had it for a long time now, so I don't remember when I got it or what I paid for it. I don't think it was much, and I think I probably got it through like eBay or something. But at the time, I had specifically sought this out after learning that it even existed, because I've always liked first meetings of superheroes, particularly when there's a bit of fanfare given to it, and had a very brief obsession with trying to collect them, which I eventually just kind of backed off from because a lot of them are just stupid expensive. But this one, at least at the time I acquired it, wasn't terribly expensive. And I got it in, you know, pretty good condition and everything. And yeah, I always liked this because I always liked these two guys. I always liked these two characters. And I love having them both, you know, together. you know, not only in these stories, but I don't know if you're much of a gamer, but I love having these two guys on my teams when I play like the Marvel Ultimate Alliance games, because I find that there's very few adversaries that have a defense in those games against both fire and ice attacks. So when you have both these guys on your team and they both attack at the same time, they really kick some ass. So they're really great characters.
Yeah, I've never actually played the game. I liked video games very much when I was a youngster, but I really haven't been. I haven't played them since my son got to the point where he would play alone. I think the last time I played was, you know, when he was young enough that he would play with me. And well, that was long ago.
I would say those games, at least in my experience, are much more fun as a communal experience, you know, playing with at least one other person. But, sure. But you know, knowing you the way I think I do and knowing what a big Marvel fan that you are, I really think you'd get a kick out of it because they're chock full of Easter eggs, and the people that write the stories and you know, do all the stuff with the characters, they really know the stuff and they're very passionate about it. So, and you can feel that in the different versions of the games. But
what anyway. Type of platform do you play that on, just to
on that? Oh, geez, that's a good question. I'm trying to remember. Well, the latest one, or at least the latest one I have, the latest one I'm aware of, was Ultimate Alliance 3, which was on the, what's the latest Nintendo? The Switch? Yeah, the Switch. Yeah, and that was good. That was a really good game. It had a giant roster of characters, which was really cool because it has all the obvious people like, you know, Spider-Man and the Avengers and all that, but then it got really obscure with like Elsa Bloodstone and Morbius and, you know, just some characters you wouldn't necessarily think that they would bother with, you know, in a video game. So that was pretty cool. But yeah, I've enjoyed all the original ones. I played on, I think it was the original Xbox or GameCube, one of those two systems. But yeah, there's been so many, and then they get confusing because there was also the X-Men games, which were essentially the same thing, but of course it was just the X-Men characters. It didn't have, you know, like the Fantastic Four and stuff like that. So those get a little fuzzy in my head because there's been so many of them. But yeah, they're all fun. They're all those what do they call them, like the RPG games. So anyway
back to our story at hand.
Yeah, you just want to run through the issue?
Sure. I really didn't have much of a note on the cover, except, you know, it has the separated title from the artwork, which I'm never a fan of that.
Right.
But otherwise, I think it's well drawn, and despite the fact that it's a little busy, I think it comes off well because it kind of gives us exactly what we have. Human Torch meets the Iceman, and they're both, you know, they're both prominent on it.
Yeah.
So I'm kind of cool with that. On the splash page, what is Sue doing? Is she on the phone? Is that, you know, what? And what's up with her hair?
She's got like a, yeah, I don't know, like a beetle.
She's got like a bubble head.
Yeah, something weird's going. Yeah, what is that thing? Is that maybe that is a phone. Let's just see. Yeah, her dialogue doesn't give any indication of what she, yeah, it's like
plugged into whatever it is the thing is handling.
It looks like she's like maybe it's a microphone. He looks like he's like doing the rap thing, you know, with the record, you know, the scratch thing. You know what I'm talking about?
Yes, like, I sadly do.
It looks like an amp, and like that's a turntable, and like he's dropping some mad beats or something. I don't know. It's funny now that I really look at it. But yeah, the thing she's holding up to her face or her head looks like a. It looks like a futuristic old-timey phone, if that makes any sense. Yeah.
Yeah, what they would, you know, what old-timeys would draw as a futuristic phone.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, also on the splash page, two more points. I mean, most of my points are on the splash page. I like that, you know, it's Iceman's guest appearance through courtesy of X-Men magazine.
Yeah.
Which reminds me of the end of The Adventures of Superman when they would say Superman appears in Superman magazine. and you know, there's that, which I just got a kick out of that. But then the fact that the headline is X-Men Battle Brotherhood of Evil Mutants. I was always under the impression, and remain under the impression with the exception of this book, that the early adventures of the X-Men were kind of done much, much more covertly.
Yes.
That they were not really a known entity throughout the Marvel Universe. I mean, this thing, you know, it lays it all out. You know, they say here the X-Men are all mutants. They were born with their powers instead of getting it accidentally like we did. So it would be as if, you know, not only are they well known, but then they did interviews where they explained how their powers came about.
Exactly. See, I was going to ask you on this. I thought you might have more information because, I mean, I've never been the biggest X-Men fan, but I'm very ignorant about the new X-Men, you know, that came out of Giant Size X-Men, number one, because I just never really had any interest in that stuff. So I was really surprised to open the splash page here and you've got, you know, Johnny reading the paper going, boy, the X-Men sure are getting a lot of publicity lately. And I was the same way as you. I was like, well, I thought they were always like operating from the shadows and, you know.
More or less. The only, you know, I've read all of the X-Men's pre-new X-Men appearances or everything before the series was canceled. And, you know, yeah, they were definitely a more covert group. But they did have, Professor X had a relationship with somebody I believe was in the FBI named Duncan, if I remember right. And he, you know, he would report to that guy. But that wasn't a newspaper relationship. That was a government relationship.
Right.
So, you know, there wasn't, I believe this was a mistake by Stan Lee. The other thing that just stood out to me, and again, I really didn't have many notes, but the only other thing that stood out to me was when the Iceman melts his exterior form to go to the boat, his comment is, "Ooh, it's chilly without my ice coating," which I'm going to no prize this as saying both the Human Torch and the Iceman are early on in their careers enough that they don't have total control over their powers. But yeah, Eventually, you know, the Torch would be able to absorb all heat and, you know, that type of thing. And actually, the Iceman was able to absorb heat as well. Because I remember there was a story, and I can't remember the specifics of when it was, but I remember there was something where he had to absorb the heat and this giant ice would form because he took all the heat out of the atmosphere and all the... The same thing happened with the Torch in one issue where, yeah, Reed was doing some sort of experiment where he needed the absolute cold.
Yeah, you're right. Because for a time, Bobby had to wear a special belt that I want to say it was an Asgardian thing. I can't remember, but something had happened to him. Like he'd been whammied by Loki or something and he lost control of his powers, and so he was sucking the heat out of everything around him type of thing. And so he had to wear does this ring a bell at all? Do you remember that?
Vaguely, but I think it's really when I wasn't reading them. So I don't have a great understanding of it.
But I had the same note about, you know, this must be early, you know, for both of the characters, because it struck me as odd that to get to the ship, Iceman forms essentially an ice slide, but it's on the ground and it only goes to the end of the pier. When he actually has to get to the ship, he pole vaults. Mm-hmm. So I'm like, well, why didn't he just do an ice slide? But apparently he didn't have that power yet, because at the end of the story, when he leaves the ship, he forms basically an ice flow and walks across it. He doesn't do his ice slides. So I guess
I would have to look at the very early issues, but I'm not sure when they started with the ice slides, but I thought it was pretty early on. So I don't know. But he also, at this point, he's still in the very rough snowman stage.
Yeah.
So it's very early on. This is probably, you know, around X-Men number 4, 5, 6, somewhere around there. So,
right.
You know, he didn't have a lot of appearances as yet.
And then with Johnny battling the blaze on the ship, I was trying to figure out, is this Stan creating a way for the pirates to throw Johnny overboard, or did he not yet have the ability to absorb flame? And I don't know which is the correct answer here.
I'm guessing he always had the ability, but maybe hadn't yet honed it.
Right.
Or at least Stan hadn't decided it was time to take advantage of it.
I just enjoyed the story and really didn't have a whole lot of notes or nitpicks or anything. Really, my only other big note on this was page 2 when it switches from the FF to the X-Men. When the scene changes, the caption box says, "Meanwhile, in Westchester County," and immediately in my mind, I thought, which is not upstate New York.
Well, it depends on how you define upstate, honestly.
Well, see, at work, I get people a lot, I always like to ask where people are visiting from. And I get a lot of people that will answer upstate New York. And it gets me all excited because I'm thinking my neck of the woods. I say, "Oh, where upstate?" And almost invariably, they'll say Westchester County. And I'm like, no.
We people who live downstate, New York City, Long Island, and such, are as egocentric as the Human Torches in this issue.
Right.
So outside of us, we're not really willing to admit that anything else exists.
Right.
So as soon as you get north of the Bronx,
yep,
it's upstate.
Yep. Now, see, for people like me that are from the opposite end of the state from you, to me, anything below Albany is New York City, and anything above Albany is, that's upstate New York. So,
yeah, but so our lines are... The difference is there's 8 of you and there's like a million of me.
Right. let's see. Is that all? Yeah, that's pretty much all of my notes. You know what? I enjoy this so much. It's just fun. And I'm going to call this Exhibit A for all those people on the internet who keep yammering on about superhero movie fatigue and how the MCU is all played out. We haven't even gotten to these guys yet. So don't give me that.
As far as the MCU, I mean, we've seen both of them on film, but we haven't seen them, in the current iteration.
Right.
Now, my only other note that I had on this, and I hate ever slagging on Jack Kirby, but when he shows Bobby in his ice form, his anatomy becomes a little bit less detailed. And I understand, you're showing him in a snowman state, but just for example, page 2, when they show him walking away from Professor X, look at his right leg. It looks like he's got a gimpy leg. and there's several points where his legs don't look quite right. So I just guess it's Kirby, giving less attention to detail, and then, Dick Ayers inking it and not bothering to add that detail in. But I think it betrays him a little bit.
It is funny seeing Iceman looking like a snowman wearing a hat.
You should have the corncob pipe.
Right. Corncob pipe, a carrot nose. Yeah, that's funny.
And two eyes made out of coal. Okay. So I guess we're going short on this particular one. But, I guess it's my book, so I'll rate it. I think the cover is pretty cool. Whatever it was 2 weeks ago when I bought, actually, when you mentioned about buying these, I think I bought this for $5.
Oh, damn. That's excellent.
That's a good deal. Decent shape. Not excellent shape, but probably a 4.0 if you were going to rate it, for like $5. So I was happy with this. And the cover, now getting back to the ratings, the cover still attracted me, even though I've been looking for a lot of these Strange Tales issues. But I've been looking for them on the cheap, frankly. The only ones that I'm kind of willing to break the bank a little bit on are the first appearance of Doctor Strange, which I probably will never own. And I had spent a little bit more, still under $100, but a little bit more on the first Nick Fury Agent of S.H.I.E.L.D. one.
Because
that was a key issue. And that one I got in very good shape, so I still think I got a very good buy on that. But now back to this. I thought the cover was still attracting me. I think it's well drawn. I really like the way the colors play on this. And the inking looks much better than it does inside. So I'm going to say a solid B+ on the cover. I really like it. The interior art, I'm not quite as high on. It's good, but it's more serviceable, and I really don't like the way Kirby is drawing the women's hair, which goes to that little skit that him and Stan did. There was like an audio skit where they did where Stan says, "Oh, that, you know, people are commenting about Sue's hair," and Jack is like, "What am I, a hairdresser now?" Something along those lines. So I'm falling right into place with that I don't think he really got a good look for them. But anyway, other than that, I think it's good. So I'm going to say a B on the interior art. And the story is just plain, simple, fun, and it's a shorter story. So again, we didn't get a chance to get into a lot of the sub-dynamics of the meeting of the two, but we definitely got a fun story as far as I was concerned, and not too many holes to poke in it. So I'm going to say a B-plus on the story, and overall, I'm going to say a B-plus on the book.
Okay. I don't think I'm that far off from you. I really like this cover. I think what saves it for me is the color. It really pops, because otherwise, I mean, yes, the heroes are kind of sort of front and center, but only the torch is really doing anything. You know, he's streaking in, you know, with a trail of flame behind him. Iceman's just kind of standing there. So if you weren't familiar with Iceman, I don't know that he'd particularly wow you. He just looks like kind of an amorphous snowman, really. I think there should be something where he's like demonstrating his powers, like maybe, you know, doing some sort of ice blast, or, you know, maybe there's like a haze of snowflakes, or I don't know, something just to kind of showcase his powers a little bit too. But I mean, it is a really cool cover, nonetheless. I think I'll go a B plus on the cover, because I do like the way it really, you know, visually pops. Interior art, I'm with you. I think it's Dick Ayers. I mean, not to slag the guy, but I've seen a lot of stuff. I forget what I've been reading recently that had a lot of Dick Ayers, both artwork and inking in it. And I think in this case, I'm just not sure he's the best inker for Kurt. He seems to have a really heavy, pen in this. Although there are some things I love how Johnny's hair looks, on the opening splash page. I mean, it's very Superman, and it's like very like burn Superman, but I really like that. I wish I could get my hair to do that. But yeah, it's just
give up on that one.
Yeah, I know, right? But I mean, the art by no means is bad or anything. It is very dynamic. I really enjoy it. I like the showcasing of, you know, the powers and all that sort of thing. Some really good perspective shots. So art wise, I think I will also go a B plus on the art. And story wise, I think I'm just a little bit higher on it than you. I'm going to go an A on the story. I really enjoyed it. Really, the only thing that knocks it down for me is that Captain Barracuda is just, he's kind of a dorky. I mean, is this guy really much of a, I guess it's because he's, you know, there's civilians on the ship. I guess that's really the threat, is that he could harm the civilians. But if it weren't for them, I mean, you know, the torch or Iceman alone could take this guy out in, you know, 2 minutes. So I guess it's really the threat to the civilians, but he is really a goofy villain. And
I like when they have him talk like an old time pirate. Hey, come on, you swabs.
Right. piracy on the Hudson. And it's not like this was like a, you know, a cruise ship where there were, you know, millionaires and, you know, women with fancy jewels. This is just like some teenage party or something, right? I mean, are they really going to net enough money to even make this worth the effort? I mean, because look at how many people Barracuda employs here. I mean, is this financially viable for him to even be doing what he's doing?
Here's your $2, matey.
Right.
Yeah, I didn't even think about that aspect of it. Yeah, especially since like the whole story is based on, oh, there's a lot of swinging teenagers on this trip,
right?
You know, I mean, if I, you know, I think I was like one when this came out, but if I was a teenager at that time, I would imagine I probably would have about $5 on
me. Yeah, that was my first thought, is that you know, I don't know about the torch, because he always seemed to have, you know, spare cash and everything, but you know, weren't the teenagers in old Marvel books like this always grousing about the fact that they were broke? So, I mean, how much is Barracuda and his people? How much are they netting on this venture? I just don't think it's very much. So,
yeah, it would have been probably a better thing, and it could have easily been corrected in the dialogue to have the story be that they were actually, you know, hijacking the ship,
right,
and taking it. Right. That probably would have been a better or more logical story, at least.
Just because I made note of it, here's where it's reprinted. It was reprinted in Marvel Tales number 22 in 1969. The Essential Human Torch trade paperback 2003, which I think is where I first read it, because I used to have that trade. Marvel Masterworks Volume 1, number 114, Human Torch Volume 2 hardcover. And apparently there was a variant of that book as well. I don't know what the variation is. And then Human Torch and the Thing, Strange Tales, the Complete Collection trade paperback 2018. All right, we are right on to the next book.
Let's go.
All right.
Now we're getting, just for background, we're getting really into I just started collecting comics, and I am so into it that, you know, I love every issue.
Ah, so this is your sweet spot then.
Yeah, I think my first issue of Marvel Team-Up was maybe issue 19 or 20, somewhere around there.
Who was it?
So we're at 23. Spider-Man and the Black Panther. I think that was number 20.
Okay. This was actually a comment for later in my notes, but I'll throw it out right now. You know, once again, I'm reminded of all the time and effort and money that went into me collecting complete runs of both this title and Marvel 2-in-1, and yet if I've read a third of either of those runs, I'd be amazed. I really need to find the time to sit down and plow through both of them, because anytime we cover them on the show, I almost invariably end up with, you know, a really good warm fuzzies feeling from them, whether I'd read them before or not. I just love these old team up tales. And yeah, I just need to find the time to actually devote to sit down and read them, or, you know, maybe just do them in dribs and drabs from time to time. But one way or the other, I need to read them all. I have read before, though, and that's why I brought it to the table. I'm sorry, what?
I'm sorry to interrupt you. But you go to, you know, Marvel Team Up and Marvel 2-in-1. I don't think it's just nostalgia on my part, but I do find that the earlier issues had just a lot more of an enjoyment level to me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Whereas when they started getting to the later, actually Marvel 2-in-1, I thought held up better into the later issues than Marvel Team Up did. Marvel Team Up, when we started getting into the 80s, 90s, 100s, a lot of the issues just felt like they were going through the motions to me.
Right.
But the earlier issues before that, I think there was a lot of just great stuff that went on. And I think there was a greater level of care given to them, in my opinion.
No, I agree with you. And strangely, I find that Brave and the Bold over at DC has much the same feel. You know, those early, you know, the earliest Batman team ups, like with Apero and stuff. And I'm not sure what that is. I think part of it may be nostalgia, but no, I definitely agree with you that there's, you know, they just have a different energy to them. With the Marvel stuff, I think it's just because this period, this early 70s, is still kind of the Wild West in a lot of ways for Marvel. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. They were throwing out a lot of weird stuff just to see if it stuck, and just doing some just fun and experimental things. And I think that might be part of the energy behind them or something. But no, I agree with you. And it's kind of hard to define why I feel that way, but I definitely do agree with you on that.
I also think there's an element, I mean, you know, we compare it to Brave and the Bold with Bob Haney writing them and just coming up. Like, his thought process, I think, was, I don't care. These two characters are getting together.
Right.
Who cares if they existed 600 years apart from each other? They're together.
right.
Whereas I think in Marvel, they were always trying to come up with some sort of a reason for why these characters would meet. And I just think they ran out of gas on that too. Whereas, like, after a while, like, I'd say, yeah, they did, you know, like, they started to throw their hands up in the air, and it didn't feel as organic, because they didn't put it, like, it felt to me like they didn't put it quite as much thought into it.
Oh, I agree with you there, because one of the things that really impresses me with this one right out of the gate is you see how tied to the continuity of the time this tale is. I mean, on the surface of it, it might appear to just be a throwaway. Oh, it's just a team up between these guys. But then when you get into the story, you realize, oh no, this is part of the overall Marvel universe that was unfolding at the time. There's other things happening in the background. This ties into other stories. And like you say, when you get later down the line into, the mid to late 80s, it was more of, that's just too much work. You know, the universe has gotten too big. There's too many moving parts. And, I didn't feel like there was that investment to let you know when this story is happening and how that fits into Spider-Man and his regular ongoing continuity. And then the guest star, what's going on with them. There was less of that later on. It was just, oh, they just run into each other and have a team up. And it was more throwaway than something like this that actually has those branches, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, exactly. So all that said, why don't we get into this particular tale? But my final thought on that is, this is the same time when they started coming out with the giant size issues.
Yes.
So giant size Spider-Man number one is out at the same time as this, roughly. I mean, there may be a week or so off, but it's the same month.
Right.
And since Spider-Man is pretty much the star of this particular team-up book, they actually kind of give a tip of the hat to, oh, here's where Spider-Man is, and yep. You can see him in Giant Size Spider-Man number one, yep, teaming up with Dracula, of all people.
Yep.
I appreciated that.
Well, you're kind of stealing my notes a little bit, but that's all right.
Sorry about that.
All right, so this is Marvel Team Up number 23, cover date of July 1974 on this. On sale date was April 23rd, 1974, according to Mike's Amazing World of Comics. I had just turned all of 6 years old. Cover price, 25 cents. Cover by Gil Kane, penciler, and Frank Giacoya, inker, and it is a beauty, in my opinion. It depicts what was lacking from the last issue, an actual battle between the Human Torch and the Iceman, and I just love it. I think it's a beautiful perspective piece. I think each hero is showcased very well. And just a great cover that we'll get back to and talk about in the notes section on this. The Night of the Frozen Inferno was written by Len Wein with art by Gil Kane and inks by Mike Esposito, edited by Roy Thomas. We open to an absolutely stunning splash page, an awesome and vertigo-inducing perspective shot of the Human Torch accompanying the launch of a borrowed Sky Flyer in which Spider-Man whisks away to his fated rendezvous with Count Dracula. And yes, we're serious about that. We learn via editor's note that our story actually began in a completely different book, Giant Size Spider-Man number one, to be precise, and that's where the web slinger is headed back to. Seems that adventure began with the Webbed One stumbling across a robbery at Faversham Jewelers in Midtown East, but he failed to catch the crook because he slipped on a patch of ice in 60-degree weather. He then went to visit his ever-dying Aunt May and learned that the only hope for the old biddy this time is a vaccine created by a guy who's currently on a ship at sea. So Spidey went to the Fantastic Four to borrow this flivver to get to the ship, and that's where he's off to. Back at the Baxter Building, Torch finds himself bored and craving action. He decides to follow up on the whole Faversham thing and zips over where he finds the ice patch still hasn't melted despite the temperature outside. As he investigates, he is clubbed in the back by an ice bolt. And assuming he knows exactly who threw it, he angrily streaks off and flies around until he just happens to find exactly who he's looking for. The Iceman.
The Iceman cometh.
Who's just ice sliding around and above the streets of the city. The Torch attacks and attempts to arrest Iceman, but the X-Man maintains his innocence and ignorance of just what the heck the Human Torch is even going on about. An epic duel of fire versus ice ensues, the two opposite numbers locked in mortal combat, and it's a nicely illustrated demonstration of each's powers and abilities. Unfortunately, it is broken up by the arrival of Iceman's teammates, the X-Men, as they show up and Cyclops puts an end to it all with a well-placed force beam. The X-Men explained that they've been looking all over for Iceman ever since he rushed off a half an hour ago because Professor X has a mission for them. Johnny then realizes that if Iceman was with his teammates a half an hour ago, then he couldn't have been the jewelry thief. Pissed off that somebody is pinching his gig, Iceman tells the X-Men he'll meet up with them later in time for their mission, which will turn out to be the one in giant size X-Men number one, by the way, and decides to go after the thief himself. Johnny feels badly about how he jumped to conclusions and offers to assist Bobby. So the two team up and return to Faversham's once again, just in time to witness an explosion blow out a wall of the shop. Investigating, the two are struck by fire and ice bolts fired by a mysterious figure in a weird metallic suit. Iceman blasts him and the torch bodily tackles him, tearing the metallic suit in the process. The thief sheds his protective covering and stands revealed as Equinox, the thermodynamic man. And he is simultaneously one kind of cool and pretty goofy looking dude. The fight is on. The Human Torch and the Iceman versus the one villain with both of their powers. And it seems to me like he's holding his own pretty well and may even be more powerful than the Fire and Ice team. But for some strange reason, the approach of police sirens freaks him out and he panics and flees. I mean, what the fuck did police going to do against these against a guy who's holding his own against these two? But whatever. Torch and Iceman pursue, and after some very excellent battle scenes, they eventually both blast Noxia at the same time, and the combination of their powers with his building internal reactions causes him to explode, seemingly blown to atoms. However, the duo does notice the blast knocked a hole through the street and down into the sewer system, so maybe he just escaped. Spoiler, he did. He'll be back in issues 59 and 60 by Chris Claremont and John Byrne.
They fight the Wasp and the Yellow Jacket.
Yep.
Yeah, that's a pretty, you know, still when Marvel team up was still good.
Yep, absolutely.
The art in this book, cover and the issue, is the Gil Kane that I absolutely love.
Yep.
I just sat here poring over it and I loved it. Everything in it. So go ahead.
Oh no, I completely agree with you. I would love a poster, a t-shirt, both, either of this cover. I think this cover is absolutely gorgeous. I love it. I mean, you talk about eye-catching, eye-popping. It's just, it's phenomenal. It's a really, really nice perspective shot of, you know, you've got, I just realized that the torch is actually shattering Iceman's ice slide. He should be just plummeting at that point, but maybe the fall hasn't started yet. But yeah, it's
immediate, I guess.
Yeah, but just a great cover that, you know, like I said before, it really showcases both of them. You get exactly what they're about here. You've got, you know, the torch streaking out of the sky with a trail of fire behind him, holding a fireball ready to throw it. You've got Iceman on his ice slide. He's casting some sort of ice, maybe a snowball, maybe an ice ball, an ice blast, something. He's throwing something at a Human Torch. It's a really, really great cover. And the interior art I love because, you know, again, I, like you, I love Gil Kane. And I'm kind of hot and cold on Mike Esposito, but I like it here because, call me crazy, but I'm seeing some very strong Ross Andrew influence, because I know Esposito was you know, very frequently teamed with Andrew. And I look at this splash page, and you know what I'm reminded of? I'm reminded of Superman versus the Amazing Spider-Man, because that was Andrew on that. And I'm pretty sure that was Esposito that inked. I could be wrong on that, but that's what it reminds me of. Just the, especially that ship and the perspective shot, you know, over the island of Manhattan and everything. It's just, that's beautiful. But I mean, the art through the whole book is just, yeah, it's fantastic. When Gil Kane is on, it's great stuff. And this is great Gil Kane in this.
Yeah, I agree totally. And I mean, totally, because I had the same thoughts about Mike Esposito that, you know, Mike Esposito, to me, always struck me as a guy who, he needed to lean on whoever the penciler was. He wasn't going to really bring a penciler up. So, you know, he needed to have good pencil work before, you know, in order for him to do good work. And I'm just thinking Kane really just put his best foot forward on this one, and that Esposito did a nice job of inking it. I also was impressed by the coloring within the story, but even, you know, more so on the cover. If you look at the coloring, like, of the Iceman, there's the light blue highlights on him, and the torch has got some darker patches on him as well. And they used to do that darker patches thing on him more frequently back in the 70s, and I think it was very effective. So, you know, you got that, the white and the red and the yellow all pop against the background, which is kind of monochromatic, or I guess dual chromatic. But, you know, it really pops out. And the fact that, again, we have a cover title that isn't, you know, put into the actual artwork, that's almost hidden from my eyesight on it. I also like the, on the cover box, you know, the Human Torch, I think we had seen that particular image of him on the left side on issues of the Fantastic Four before. But, you know, it looks like they created a new one of the Iceman for the cover, too. So to have them each on each side of it, it just looks very cool.
Do you remember the, I want to say they were stickers, but there was like a Marvel trading card set right around this time, but I think they were actually stickers, and the different heroes were all saying like weird, goofy things.
Yep.
I think this was the art they used for the Human Torch, the one that's underneath the price box right there. I don't know about
Ice. I think
Man,
you're right.
That one of the torch definitely looks familiar to me. Who is that? Do you know who that artist is?
For those images, I'm not sure.
Well, for the
I wouldn't I wouldn't be surprised. I wouldn't be surprised if, well, you know what, the torch, the way he's shown there, looks to me like, of all things, looks to me a little bit like Ross Andrew.
I was thinking George Tuska by the face, but I don't know, because it reminds the face alone, not the body work or anything, but the face on that little image reminds me of Tuska's work on like Taylor and the Planet of the Apes and stuff. That's, I don't know. I could be dead wrong on that, but that's definitely what the face reminds me of. But I don't remember Tuska usually putting that much definition into the rest of a character though. So I don't know, but yeah, I'd be curious to find out.
I'd be at a loss to tell you definitively who that is.
Yeah. Let's see, notes on this one. Again, I didn't really take a lot of notes on this. I just got sucked into it. Damn it. I miss comics like this. This was just a blast from cover to cover. I love the way it's weaved into what's happening in the Marvel universe at the time. You know, this is actually, you know, the beginning of this story is taking place simultaneously and within the first chapter of Giant Size Spider-Man number one. I just think that's really neat. You know, it's that, you know, that the two are, you know, coming together and then diverging into separate tales like that. I think that's neat. I wish they had stuck with, you know, doing more stuff like this. I think that lends a sense of, I don't know, maybe importance isn't the right word, but a sense of weight to the earlier issues of something like this. It was the same thing with Spectacular Spider-Man in the beginning was, you know, was heavily weaved into what was going on with Spider-Man in other books. And so is Marvel Team-Up for that matter. It felt to me like they were really making an effort to make it all feel like one story, you know, as real as possible with an actual timeline. And then later on, it's just like they just gave up.
Mm. Excuse me, but it's even more so than just the fact that they have the, you know, the little nod to what's going on in Giant Size Spider-Man, because if you know, the dialogue that the Torch has got, especially, you know, when he's sitting alone lamenting what's going on in his life, he's kind of hitting on what's going on in the FF issues regularly. Right. And then, you know, I really appreciated that they tried to keep the X-Men alive after their book was canceled and keep things going. And then it almost feels like, you know, Bobby, Professor X says you got to come home now. Oh, man, can't I go chase this villain first? You know, so I got a big kick out of it. I got a really kick out of this entire issue, much like yourself. I you know, and again, I don't think it's all nostalgia. I think that this truly is a top-notch issue that anybody could... This is what is meant to be in these team-up stories.
Yeah.
This is the way they should be done, and they weren't always done this way. You know, there's a different level of success and failure on these.
Well, one thing that's fun to point out is just the simple fact, and I wonder if people even are aware of this today, that Spider-Man wasn't always in the book. I mean, yes, he's in here, but I mean, he's not the star of the book. For a time, this became a Human Torch team-up title. It didn't last very long.
Well, it was more or less, it was a Spider-Man book, but every once in a while there was a respite where the Torch would take an issue.
Right.
I don't think he ever did two issues in a row. I think it was always Spider-Man, 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 Torch. Spider-Man, 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 Torch.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah. Well, here, the Torch, it was Spider-Man in every issue up until 17, and the Human Torch was in the first three with him. Number 18 was Human Torch and the Hulk. Then number 23 is Human Torch and Iceman. Number 26 is Human Torch and Thor. 29, Human Torch and Iron Man. 32, Human Torch and the Son of Satan. So, I mean, you know, it was periodic.
You know, you're right. I never put that together before, that the Human Torch did not have two consecutive issues as the headliner. I never realized that before. I'd be curious to see a tally, though, of who appeared in the book the most, you know, beyond Spider-Man, obviously. I wonder if it is the Torch, because at least for the first half or so of the title, he's in it a lot. I mean, as you say, he's in it the first three issues, but then he's in it quite a bit after that, too.
I would say he would most likely be...
Yeah,
you know, a runaway number two, because there were also, you know, Spider-Man and the Human Torch issues.
Right.
But this is I'm sorry. Go ahead. I was going to say this is just terrific. I can't put enough superlatives on this, and I just keep going to the artwork. I love this. There's a shot where, you know, when the Torch first decides to go out and look for action, and he starts to flame on. And instead of just having him, boom, he's on fire, they show his face, and you're like, there's little eruptions of flame that are coming on him.
Yeah.
And I just love that effect, and I'm hoping to see that in live action.
Well, I tell you, I was so excited to find... so, you know, as I always like to do, I like to go and look up the issues, you know, because there's the different fandom wikis that are out there. And a lot of times you can learn, you know, fun little facts that, you know, may not be obvious about the issue. And sometimes, you know, a little behind the scenes information or whatever, you know, the different threads that you can pull on with different comics. So I punched Marvel Team Up 23 into a Google search. And when the results came up, one of the images... you know, it was real tiny on my, I think it was on my phone or my iPad. And I'm like, what is that? Let me blow that up. And I blew it up, and holy cow, there was an action figure set, called Fire and Ice. That is the Human Torch and the Iceman, that looks to me, to all the world, like it might be based on this particular issue. Now, Iceman is more of his 90s incarnation, where he didn't have like the defined mouth, and he had like the big spiky ice things coming off him. But the Human Torch basically looks like the Human Torch on page two that you're pointing out, where he's not fully flamed on yet, but he's got, you know, the flames kind of crackling off him. And he is in the orange and yellow outfit like here. And I just got to say, I have always loved this outfit for the Human Torch. I just think it's cool. I just think it pops. I know he didn't wear it for very long, you know, relatively speaking, but I always really liked that outfit. I always thought it was really cool. I liked that it was different from the rest of the FF.
It was a throwback to the original Human Torch.
Yep. Yep. 60 degrees is warm.
Well, in my world, it's very comfortable. In your world, people wear winter coats.
Well, it's just Spider-Man makes a comment. I'm not sure if it's in this issue or if it was in Giant Size Spider-Man, because I did go over and look there briefly just to get the preface of this story. But he does make a comment, and he makes it like with an exclamation part, like, and it's 60 degrees outside. And I'm thinking, down here, people be wearing like scarves and parkas and stuff. Dude, 60 degrees is not warm. But in New York, yeah, it's a different thing. So
I keep joking around about how, I guess it's like 2 years ago, I was down by you guys in December. And, you know, we went for one of our usual comic hunting days. And Dr. Bill came over and picked me and Ken up. And Ken came out wearing a pair of jeans, and Bill was wearing a pair of jeans. And I came out wearing a pair of shorts and a t-shirt. And the two of them started laughing. They were like, oh, look at this guy. He's wearing a pair of shorts in December. He thinks Florida is so hot. Meanwhile, by the end of the day, it was like 80-something degrees, and the two of them were sweating their asses off.
Yep. Yep.
So, I think they had to impress me with, you know, that they could wear jeans in the warm weather. You know what? I wasn't so impressed.
Yeah, I haven't totally acclimated yet, because there are very, very few periods of the year in Florida where I'm not in shorts and a t-shirt. It just never, to me, it just never gets that yeah. cool, that cold.
And frankly, an ice patch on the ground in 60 degree weather would not last an hour.
Right.
So you know, he is right to say what he's saying. Just, you know, one other note is just that the Iceman's ice bridge, as when the torch first approaches him, there is no way the laws of physics would allow that to exist.
Right. I think of that every. I think eventually, I could be wrong, but I think eventually that did start to get addressed, where every once in a while you'd see like a pillar, you know, like mm-hmm. a what do you call it, like a
well, a support beam.
So yeah, like a support beam type of thing. Yeah, because you're right. Yeah. Its own weight would cause it to crack and fall. But I love it nonetheless.
Oh, yeah. No question.
And
you know, the character of Equinox, he came back. Not a bad character. You know, not really a Mort, even though a lot of the team-up book villains were Morts.
Right.
You know, I thought he had some potential. And, I do know he came back in team-up and was, you know, fairly threatening. I don't know when he's appeared after that. He probably has, but
yeah, there's, you know, a whole not a bad page character on him. I kind of got, I looked it over briefly, and then I kind of got bored with how it just went on and on. But yeah, he was not a one and done, even after this and the next adventure I cited, where he comes back in issues 59 and 60. He came back beyond that point as well. I think I kind of vaguely remember seeing him in other things, but yeah, I think he's a really cool villain. I like that not only does he have the powers of the Torch and the Iceman, but he seemed to me like he actually might be a bit more powerful than them as well. My only issue with him was just it's really his face. The rest of him looks really cool. I like the fact that he's basically like a flaming, a flaming Iceman, and that just sounds wrong, but yeah, like he's Iceman on fire, essentially, which is really cool.
It's a constantly changing, you know, his upper body's on fire, then his upper body is ice, and it goes back and forth.
But this weird, like, Wolverine mask with the pointed like Dracula teeth and the red eye, I'm like, what is that? That makes him look a little bit silly, but otherwise I think he's pretty cool.
What I wouldn't mind seeing, and maybe they even did it, I don't even know, is if you delve into the character a little bit more closely, and at some point, you know, he's captured and they're doing whatever they can to control his powers, you know, to keep him captive. And he reverts to a mostly human form, and you see what he would look like if he didn't have the ice and fire, and you kind of come up with some sort of a look for him that looks, that would make sense for him to look like that when he's iced up.
Right.
That's, I think that's, you know, one of the things I would be interested in seeing. I don't know if they ever did that.
Yeah, because I am very curious what he does look like as a regular person, given this goofy look, you know, to his face in this form. Like, what's causing him to look like that in his in his Equinox form? Is it just the look he decided to adopt, or is there an actual reason for him to look like some sort of demon thing or something?
The way this is written, I don't think it's a it would be something that he chose to do.
Right.
So, well, I mean, time will tell. We see if there's other issues. Anyway, I guess we can rate this one.
All right. So going back to the cover here, I'm going to just give the cover a straight up A+. I think it's fantastic. I have absolutely not a single qualm with it. I think it's beautiful. I think it pops. I love the perspective of it. That is a great cover. That's the kind of cover I want to see. Interior arts. It's great. I think it's really, really well staged. It's got a little bit of that scratchiness to it, a little bit. That's often a staple of Gil Kane. I've never was really all that crazy about it, but I do like Gil Kane, and I think this really looks good. And I think Mike Esposito is a really good pairing with him. So art wise on this, I think I'm going to go an A- on the artwork, and then the story. Yeah, honestly, I think I'm going to go a straight up A on the story. Well, maybe even an A+ on the story, because I mean, I don't have any qualms with the story either. I didn't think there were any goofy moments. I didn't think there was anything, you know, you could poke a hole in or whatever. I mean, it moves, it does what it needs to do, and it was a hell of a lot of fun. So overall grade for the entire book, I will give it a straight up A. I think it was fantastic. I had a blast with it. You know, the ones like this where I just sit down, plow through them, have a lot of fun, and don't really have a lot of notes, they're kind of the tougher ones to do on the show, because it's like I don't really have a lot to say other than I really liked it. You know, I really had a lot of fun with it. But that, I mean, that's what it was. I just enjoyed this, and man, I miss comics like this.
Yeah, me too. And I'm not going to vary off you very much. I think the cover's an A+. No question in my mind. I have nothing to say negative about it. The interior art, I'm going to say the interior art is great, but it doesn't quite have the level of the cover. So I'm going to just say an A instead of an A+.
Right.
The story, I think the story is an A as well, because it's entertaining from beginning to end. It's got the continuity that we both love in it. Everything about it is positive. The characters are true to their personalities. They show individual personalities. You know, they're not just ciphers. So everything about it to me is, this is what a team up book should be.
Yeah.
So, you know, I'm going to say an A+ on the story, and I'm going to give the book overall an A+.
There you go. This was fun. I enjoyed this.
Absolutely. So I guess that's where we'll call it for the day. And thank you, everybody. And we'll catch you next time. Bye-bye.
Thank you so much for listening to our show, and we hope you'll continue to join us each and every week for more good old-fashioned comic book back issue awesomeness. You can contact Back to the Bins to leave feedback, comments, questions, suggestions, and criticisms via email at bins@twotruefreaks.com or by joining the Back to the Bins group on Facebook. Back to the Bins is a proud affiliate of the Two True Freaks Internet Radio Network, which you may find at www.twotruefreaks.com. Two True Freaks is a registered trademark of DiMonzo Corp of Milan, Italy. All rights reserved. Please take a moment to stop by the twotruefreaks.com site and check out their many other fine podcasts, won't you? Thanks, and we'll see you next week.